Lamentations chapter 2, verse
3.
All right. We might, just being chapter 2, and this is verse 3, we start, and we've covered two verses. The literal Hebrew rendition of Lamentations, I think, is much more forceful, even more in line not only with the Lord's Spirit, but expresses more the emotions of Jeremiah himself. And while they may seem to be slight changes, they to me, I appreciate them more. So we just review verses 1 and 2. Now we see how it reads here. How hath the Lord covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger? Well, that it certainly is explicit enough, but being that each verse in the Hebrew has to start with like A, B, C, even the way it's ingeniously arranged, it seems to even improve the rendition from our normal thinking, the Western culture, because our sentence structure is so different from those in either the Mideast or the Orient. I mean, the type of the grammatical arrangement. And so we read as follows. And there are one or two points that you don't get when you read the English. For instance, how has clouded in his anger Adonai right away? It doesn't say Jehovah, but it refers to Jehovah, and it calls him Adonai. And this is one of the places, because normally that term can refer sometimes to Jesus in the Old Testament. But it also, at times, refers to Jehovah. And when it is used for a different purpose. Now, being that it doesn't mention Jehovah, how has clouded Jehovah in his anger, but Adonai, it then brings out a point that you would never get in the English. What does the word Adonai signify? Of course, I guess in the concordance I'll say Lord. But Adonai is an affectionate term. It's a soft term. It implies the possessor has pity, compassion, love, tenderness. But now it says, how has Adonai, okay, clouded, now it's preparing us for a change. And so before, when the Lord led the Hebrew children, well, like the hymn says, about Jehovah's mercies past, that his mercies past, how he was forgiving, patient in dealing with Israel, who continually backslided, and in time after time after time, he gave them, forgave them, and gave them fresh opportunities to return to his favor. And so, by saying, now there's preparation being made for a radical change in the God of mercy, to now, eventually, the God of wrath. And How is clouded in his anger, Adonai, the daughter of Zion, cast down the beauty of Israel from heaven to earth, and not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger. Now, the word anger is all right, and it's used here. But sometimes the word anger is used for other words, which have fine distinctions of meaning in this particular book. Is this light fluttering or something?
Yeah, it
is. Now, verse 2, we're only covering the 2. Swallowed up, Adonai, all the homes of Jacob. This is the opposite of Adonai. He who was, we looked on as Adonai in our hearts and in his dealings with us, how he has changed in his dealings and he swallowed up all the homes of Jacob in his rage, not anger. There's a little difference between anger and rage. Anger is more, can be controlled. You can be very angry and kind of keep it in, but rage is where it explodes out. It comes out in the open. And destroyed the daughter of Judah and the strongholds of the daughter of Judah, made he touch to earth. He made to, as it were, collapse, to collapse to the earth. And he has defiled the kingdom and its rulers. Now we come to verse 3.
Philipper?
Yes.
In verse 1, this word footstool?
Yes.
Is that just the meaning of the whole nation, the city, or the temple?
Well, in the substance where we had read, you notice it said the daughter of Judah. Mm-hmm. So, and being the 10-tribe kingdom is already in captivity, the 10-tribe kingdom isn't there. Judah isn't even there, but Judah is the last one that the Lord dealt with, and they've gone now into captivity, so he's talking about the recent past, and therefore the nation of the 2 tribes, the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom, no longer exists. The southern kingdom lasted a little while longer, a little over a century, and now, he says, now the word footstool that the Lord uses, he uses it 3 ways. One,
the earth
is his footstool. Very good. Another is
Jerusalem,
or the city, and the temple. The temple is his footstool. But in this, it even implies Judah, you know. But that is really the nation. But what was left of the nation, the bottom half, as it were, he has just dealt with, and this is the sad state that exists. Now, in verse 3 we read, let's read Sister Esther, read 2 verses, and then Brother Darrell.
He hath cut off in his fierce anger all. He hath cut off in his fierce anger all back his right hand. He hath cut off in his fierce anger all the horn of Israel. He hath drawn back his right hand from before the enemy. He burned against Jacob like a flaming fire, which devoureth round about. He hath bent his bow like an enemy. He stood with his right hand as an adversary, and slew all that were pleasant to the eye in the tabernacle of the daughter of Zion. He poured out his fury like fire.
All right. Now, verse 3, read, he hath cut off in his fierce anger all the horn of Israel. The horn being a symbol of
power.
And all the horn, all the power, which is, it was made desolate. And he hath drawn back his right hand from before the enemy. Now, when we read this, almost everything that is stated here is why the Jew, at least back there, it is not only an expression of what God has done and what his the emotions that he had in doing what he did, but it's very dramatic. I mean, it can be visually seen. For instance, it says, he hath drawn back his right hand from before the enemy. Now, if you are all-powerful and the enemy's coming, and you wanted them to be held in check, you put your hand out with your authority out and stop it. But the enemy comes, and instead of doing that, he turns back and says, he allows the enemy to have free, as it were, free access into the beloved city. So you can see, you can sort of visualize this as it's being expressed. And it's the right hand, and usually the right hand is a symbol of
favor.
Yes. And he burned against Jacob like a flaming fire which devoureth round about. And any comments on that? Notice the word the Zion, Judah, and now Jacob. I mean, this is interesting that different terms are used. And like a flaming fire which devoureth round about. And so now the Lord is likening himself to, it's like Jeremiah is saying, he's seeing that it's as though it was in the city. Of course, he was in the northern part, up towards the Damascus gate, not too far from there. And when it happened, but he could see all that was going on at that time. And he is seeing the enemy come in and seeing this desolation, and he had prophesied this. Years, what was it, how many years? 40 years. His ministry was roughly 40 years, Jeremiah. And all that time, he told about a coming trouble. Now it's come, but even though it's come, it's like it is still. Instead of being, I told you so, and so forth, that attitude, no, he's very depressed. He's depressed at seeing this, and for instance, seeing the temple destroyed. That would be, and it was one of the seven wonders of the world. Would it not affect any loyal Jew seeing that? Even though we know that it was God said gave it over to the enemy. There are feelings involved here. Then in verse 4, he hath bent his bow like an enemy. Now it's picturing Jehovah as the enemy. Before, he used to picture it as Nebuchadnezzar. It was Nebuchadnezzar was pictured as a lion. But sometimes the Lord, instead of using Nebuchadnezzar as a lion coming down, he turns around and he's the lion. He's the lion coming down. He had bent his bow like an enemy. Now that, in the English, it's pathetic. I mean, it's we have archery tournaments, and we have a circle and a bullseye, and you pull back the bow and the arrow to see if you can hit the bullseye. But he had bent his bow, you think of like the marksmanship. And no, it's much more. The bows and arrows in war were a lot different than even those used for the slaying of animals. The slaying of animals, you have the bow and the quiver, and you pull it, and it has to be done quick. This is done that the bow is so taut and so unyielding, it's curved, that you cannot do this. You cannot pull it back this way, because you want it to pierce armor. You want it to go through, and whatever it hits, you want to go sink deep. And so what they did, they stepped on the bow, the lower half, rather than use their arm, and pulled it, oh, just as back as far as they could to the catch. Now, when they have that bow, it's like a gun loaded. And all you have to do is just a little bit, boom, it goes off. But it goes off with a tremendous... Now he's seeing the enemy straining this. All this is fearsome. If you're watching, somebody were out there and they were doing it and you're the target, it becomes a little more emotional. And it's as though the Lord is doing it. The enemy's doing it. Each of the enemy, but he's seeing this all as though that God is bending the bow, as it were, taking the place. He's using the enemy as his instrument. And stood with his right hand as an adversary. So you have it loaded, and usually most people are right-handed. And so it's the right hand that does the releasing, causes the bow to assume its flight. And slew all that were pleasant to the eye. Now this, what is pleasant to the eye? Little babies, little children, little tots, women, fair women. These are all, that the enemy has no mercy. And the enemy is so mad that they're not even thinking in the initial stage, in the fury, of taking captive, even if they're women. He's not at the minute. He. There's no discrimination. We hear about this. What is it? This week, Kerry, the senator, and all. He in Vietnam. He killed women and children, and he can't get it out of his conscience. He was told to do that. But here you're seeing this very emotional scene, and when this is put on television. I believe all this is photographed. I don't think this is wasted. Then when they read the Bible, they say, what in the world how dull we were. How powerful God's word is, and we ignored it. We wanted to just do our own thing. I'm talking about the world. They don't see the beauty of Jesus, what he did, and the sacrifice, and his motives, and God, who sent his son. All this, they had a deaf ear to. Then, it's not only that the enemy slays all that are pleasant to the eye, but it's in the tabernacle of Zion. What is it?
Of the daughter of Zion.
Daughter of Zion. Of course, the word tabernacle means tent. In the tent. And now, even though we are now living back there, in the time when the temple supplanted the tabernacle, Solomon's temple, the tabernacle was the skins replaced by, in the tabernacle and the temple, wood and frames and stone, a completely different thing. Yet when you read about the temple, the word sometimes tabernacle comes in. It's just a different format of the dwelling place. And the tenth thought of a hard building structure and calling it a tabernacle, it softens it. As God's presence, like in the days of old, when this building was not a building but was a rectangular box covered with skins, was a much more humble thing than the temple, the word tabernacle has a nicer sound. It's sort of like a homey dwelling presence of God. And so he uses terms here in the tabernacle of the daughter of Zion. And the daughter of Zion is what we, it termed it Judah in this case, but particularly in the city of Jerusalem, that the daughter of Jerusalem, of Zion, is pictured as a woman. Remember in the first chapter, when we read that, he's looking at Israel, and there's nobody there, but he's picturing it in his mind's eye as a woman, as a daughter. It's in the first chapter. And she's weeping and lonely, and nobody pays any attention to her, and they look on her desperation, and they move on, and it says no more traffic to the temple, no more the hurrah crowds and the rejoicing and the singing, gloom, and she's weeping. All this is highly figurative, symbolic language. And so we find that the daughter of Zion is a pictorial representation of the people as a whole, including whether the kings, princes, priests, whatever, judges, and the common people, that they're all pictured by the daughter of Zion, particularly as visited in Jerusalem and its immediate environs, and poured out his fury like a fire. Let us read two more verses.
The Lord was as an enemy. He hath swallowed up Israel. He hath swallowed up all her palaces. He hath destroyed his strongholds, and hath increased in the daughter of Judah mourning and lamentation. And he hath violently taken away his tabernacle, as if it were of a garden. He hath destroyed his places of the assembly. The Lord hath caused the solemn feasts and Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion, and hath despised in the indignation of his anger the king and the priest.
Right. When we read the first part of this, the Lord was as an enemy, and he hath swallowed up Israel. Notice that word, I think, was used twice before in the same chapter. This is the third time, if I'm not mistaken. He has swallowed up Israel. And Israel. Now what he's saying, why does he use that and say, instead of saying, he has swallowed up Judah?
Yeah. I'm just guessing. At this point, when Judah's taken into captivity, that ends the policy. That ends the nation.
Yeah. Before it was Israel and Judah. the ten northern tribes and Judah. Well, the ten are off the scene, and now he gobbles up the what's left. And when he swallows up Judah, he has now swallowed up both Judah and Israel, the northern kingdom. But now the term Israel incorporates all. We have said on different occasions of the past that Israel sometimes represents only the ten tribe kingdom, when you have like Judah in the thing, and sometimes it represents both together. And here it's saying he is swallowed and swallows it up. Well, if you swallow something up, there's nothing left. The temple is leveled, burnt up, the walls of the city are broken down, the city is desolate. He swallowed up the inhabitants and the buildings, and he swallowed up and left this wreck behind. He had swallowed up all her palaces. And we get a little inkling that it must have been a wonderful city, particularly since Solomon's day. Solomon, anybody who has been a tourist to Israel and has learned, let us say, a guide explains all the things Solomon did. Why, we see he did a tremendous amount of building. I mean, awesome building in Israel. Whether it's up in the Ten Tribe Kingdom or down in Judah, and like water supply and strongholds and stables for horses. And he had a lot of activity, and anything he did was like done with precision, and like a master craftsman. The Germans are usually known for that. I mean, the particularity of detail. And so here we find that her palaces, that not only was the temple something to be seen, but so was the city of Jerusalem something to be seen. And of course the palaces would be of the king and the priests and the princes, the nobility, not the regular people. No. And so all this has been brought down to naught. And he has destroyed his strongholds. Now, you'll notice, earlier, what did it use? The daughter of Zion, sometimes it says daughter of Jerusalem. It depends which part we're reading this. But now, the he is, instead of referring to the daughter of Zion, Israel. He has he hath destroyed his strongholds. That is Israel's strongholds. And this is why he brings in Jacob. And Jacob is a picture of usually... in the Bible, when you read the word Jacob, usually sometimes refers to the natural Israel in its symbolism. He had destroyed his strongholds and hath increased in the daughter of Judah mourning and lamentation. It's interesting that here is the word lamentation. The lamentations of Jeremiah, and it brings up the word. Now we read 6, and he hath violently taken away his tabernacle. That was verse 8. He violated like a garden his booth. Now, of course, you read in the reference here other words, but what happens, these that were Christians who translated the Bible from the Hebrew to the English, they're not necessarily very extremely devout. I mean, necessarily. They're sympathetic to Christianity and all, but they're scholars. But and being a scholar, sometimes you lose something, the emotional aspect here. And so we think the word should be booth, that the thought is booth rather than some of these other words. What's it have? What's it? Hedge?
Covering.
Cover. Yeah.
And covert.
Covert, yeah. Now, when you say booth, then this reminds you of some other things.
The Feast of Tabernacles, the booth.
Yeah. And those booths were temporary shelters for 7 days, the Feast of Tabernacles. And then after the Feast of Tabernacles, what did they leave them up? Why, these booths were all over Israel. They were all over. No, they would be taken down. They were put up for this religious ceremony. And so they're like a booth. And when you say booth, it suggests that it's temporary. And here they looked on the city, oh, the enemy cannot do anything. This is Jehovah's temple. This is his city. This is Zion. And here the enemy comes down and is awesomely successful in, like it says, defiling, despoiling, destroying, all kinds of words it used, this which they thought was permanent. So when they look, so that which was permanent is but as it were a booth. It's now gone. It's removed. Another thing too, in vineyards, you know, you had like, we have like here, we have immigrant workers come in and they do the harvesting, all kinds of things, all parts of the country, and they're only here a little while and they move to another, but what they do, they schedule themselves, there's a harvest of this kind of fruit there, a harvest here of something else, and in that way, they, with the one who is leading the group, negotiates with others to do their crops, and then they know it's only temporary, and then they move on to the next place where they harvest something else. Now here, in the vineyards, the booths were used, and when the crop, whether it's grapes or some other, where people temporarily lodge, and they had another reason for doing it, which you usually don't find, almost like they do today with construction. They have a trailer. What's the purpose of the trailer? It's a watchman. They watch to see that nobody walks off with the equipment, very valuable equipment, and disappears. So they have the booth. Then it's temporary, and he's there, and he has everything for himself. But when the construction is finished, then so the wagon's gone, the trailer, whatever is gone, removed. Well, so it's likening a picture of permanence as being like an illusion, like a dream, and that which we thought was permanent is gone.
Perfect.
Yes.
When we study the Jeremiah, there is somewhere it says people saying, temple of the Lord, a temple of the Lord, a temple of the Lord.
Yes.
And Jerusalem has the temples that never thought that God will forsake the temple.
Yes.
For that reason, they will not be taken. That's what they thought.
Yeah. And this will also happen with another case. In another type of instance. The Ark of the Covenant. Remember when it was taken up to Shiloh in the Ten Tribe Kingdom and was there for a while? Why, they thought we're fighting against the Philistines. Well, one way to ensure victory, we'll bring the tabernacle with us. And they brought it, and what happened? They captured it and took it. Well, that's the last thing they dreamed of. Mm-hmm. Yes. So it became, as you say, they gave them false security, so long as they were faithful to God. Oh, yes, then it would be permanent. But that wasn't the case. And he had taken away his tabernacle as if it were a garden. This is very forceful language. I mean, and you cannot read this, just read it and go and absorb it. It's impossible. You have to delay on. Now, what about a garden? Why, you build for tomatoes, you build little trellises, and you do for this and that, and then after the fruit is gone, it's all gone. It's plowed. It's plowed. And there's nothing left. And so it means that here's the city is a mass of ruins, like a garden that has served its purpose and now it's gone. He had destroyed his places of the assembly, and one of the places of the assembly was
the temple,
and then. Other places of assembly at the major gates. Remember, that's where the judge sat. The people came in, and any official announcements or any court cases, they were held in the gate. The gate isn't like our garden gate here. You know, a 2x4, two posts and a little fence. A gate was like a building that you, when you went through the gates, you had to go about 50 feet. You go 50 feet through it. And it's inside there that they had little judgment hall. So these were places of assembly. The Lord hath caused the solemn feasts and Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion. It has been estimated that different times of Israel's history, whenever there was a major feast, and those major feasts were how many?
Three.
That as many as in Jerusalem would be centered around would be almost, most of them, at least 2 million people coming from all over the small nation. Coming down. In fact, the law said that every male within a certain age bracket, it was required that they attend all three feasts if they were to be a good Jew, obeying the law. Well, you can be sure that they would come down, maybe one of them, maybe two, but only the ones who were really their conscience bothered them, they would come to all three to be obedient to the letter of the law. And in these feasts, where did they room? Where did they sleep? Where they camped? They'd be up on the hills all around Jerusalem. There wasn't room. And so they would pitch up their little tents that he would have for that occasion and sleep on the ground. And incidentally, the times of the year normally were very conducive to that. Because the early and the latter rain were timed. All when they came with their regularity, it worked out beautifully. But once they started to disobey, a lot of things happened. Look what Ezra did. Gave this speech in pouring rain. And the people stood for hours, drenched, listening to not only him, but other readers, one after the other. Because if one reader reads for 1 hour, you kind of get kind of boring. No, they had professional readers. So it's just marvelous. You can see in the Kingdom Age, you don't need cowboys and Indians. I mean, these real things were exciting, very exciting. The solemn, and here it calls the solemn feast. What was the solemn feast?
The Day of Atonement.
And the 10 days that appreciated, the days of what they call, the 9 days before called the days of awe, A-W-E. But that wasn't the only one. They had other feasts that are not written in the law itself, but other days that they memorialized, where people would, and that would be, for instance, we read, was it in Ezekiel? It mentions the different days of the year, where, when the temple was destroyed. That wasn't on specifically timed exactly on the dates of these three feasts. Mm-hmm. They would say when the enemy started the siege, when he broke into the city, and it had different days that they assembled. And these were solemn assemblies. But of the major feasts, the three major ones, it was the Day of Atonement, and that was the solemn feast. The other solemn feasts were the days they memorialized when the enemy despoiled them in one form or another. And it enumerates them.
5th month, 7th month, 9th month.
Yeah, that's right.
Month.
Very good. Yes. That's pinpointed and spoken of elsewhere. And he had forgotten and had despised in the indignation of his anger the king and the priest. He had despised in the indignation. And what was the king that he despised?
Zedekiah.
Right, Zedekiah. He was taken up to Riblah, mm-hmm. and his eyes were put out. His sons were slain. Before his eyes were put out, he saw them being slain, and then his own eyes were put out, and then the priest, who was the priest? Sariah. He was put to death. The priest, the high priest, the king and the high priest. So yeah, this is a... And next, we didn't read. Let's read 7 and 8.
The Lord hath cast off his altar. He hath abhorred his sanctuary. He hath given up into the land, into the hand of the enemy, the walls of her palaces. They have made a noise in the house of the Lord, as in the day of a solemn feast. The Lord hath purposed to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. He hath stretched out a line. He hath not withdrawn his hand from destroying. Therefore he made the rampart and the wall to lament. They languished together.
Right. The Lord had cast off his altar. And let's take the tabernacle, the altar, using that because it's a more simplified picture. The priest, even though he was the priest and he's robed with his clean garments, he still had to, before he could go ascend up to the altar to make offerings, he had to wash his hands and feet. Which would say that that altar is so holy that you just don't, when you feel like it, walk up, even if you got the position of the priest, the high priest, you did not have that liberty. You had to go through the ceremonial act of washing your hands and feet, and therefore, if the court, the inner court, is holy, the in the tabernacle there's only one court, the altar was even more holy. So we have, like, in the tabernacle, the first compartment is called the holy. And then you go into the most holy. Well, in the court was holy, but the altar was more holy. In fact, when a person had the last resort to do, what would they aspire to do?
They ran their hands on the horns of the altar.
Yeah. And they, of course, not Solomon's altar, I mean, that was, they would then have to have only one because of the measurement. But as far as the tabernacle, yes. They would strain. And what happened, that was the Supreme Court, the altar. That was the highest authority that they could go to. The people could go into the tabernacle. They were allowed to go in on the days subsequent to the Day of Atonement. Many Bible students in the past have not seen that point and have built doctrines up that are not in harmony with what actually occurred in the without going into the detail. So that was the highest resort, and then you would appeal to Jehovah. And of course one fellow did that, and he was slain irregardless. Others were given a temporary respite. I'm back here now. He hath given into the hand of the enemy the walls of her palaces. That is the protection of that they had in the past. Didn't mean anything. And for instance, in France, they had what they called the Maginot Line. And that was built at great expense by France, because Germany, the history of Germany and France were not the best. And so in order to have protection, they built this wall. Well, that wall didn't mean anything in the Second World War. That was like a paper fence. The tanks, if they couldn't go, they could clamber over it, and they could go through it, a bucket, and the airplanes could fly over it. I mean, so here, the king and the priests in their premises had guards. They had outer walls to their residences, so that if anybody wanted to had ill with their type of fortification, the things that were protecting them came to naught, and therefore the enemy just went in. But now it mentions about some kind of a noise. When we read here, they have made a noise in the house of the Lord as in the day of a solemn feast. Who's the they?
Enemy.
Yeah. See, instead of the singing, dancing, laughter, joy, glory, hallelujah, is the opposite, an opposite noise of the enemy enjoying the slaughter. Yes.
I just wanted to ask you a question on Sariah. I thought he was...
On who?
Sariah, the one that you said was the priest.
Yeah.
I just can't remember. Wasn't he the one they called the Quiet Prince, and he helped Jeremiah?
Yeah, but there's other Jeremiah. There's other Jeremiahs. There's other, almost anybody you mention, there's a duplicate. No, it's separate. The Lord hath purposed to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. He hath stretched out a line. He hath not withdrawn his hand from destroying. Therefore he made the rampart and the wall to lament. They languished together. Any comments on that? So any fortification on the part of those defending the city was brought to naught, and anything that the enemy did in their intent to destroy the city was successful. So you had defeat on one side, victory on the other as far as doing it, and it was won like, as it were, a holocaust of human and material structures. Let's read 9 and 10.
Her gates are sunk into the ground. He hath destroyed and broken her bars. Her king and her princes are among the Gentiles. The law is no more. Her prophets also find no vision from the Lord. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit upon the ground and keep silence. They have cast up dust upon their heads. They have girded themselves with sackcloth. The virgins of Jerusalem hang down their heads to the ground.
All right. So we've had enough pictorial representation of the detail of the destruction, and now mentions the gates being sunk to the ground, and he had destroyed and broken the bars of the gates. Now we come to the part, her king and princes are among the Gentiles.
They're taken captive.
And that was what?
Taken captive.
Yes, taken captive. The king and also what we call today heirs to the throne, too. But the ones that were spared as heirs to the throne.
Jehoiachin.
They, what?
Jehoiachin.
That's right. But he was not in the siege, so he was already there.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones who were heirs to the throne at the time that Zedekiah was in the city, they were also destroyed. The king and the princes. And the king was, his eyes put out, but he was brought to Babylon. And that's why there were two prophecies. One that he would see like Babylon, and yet he was blind.
Mm-hmm.
But that meant that he would visit. He would be taken. He would experience being taken captive to Babylon. But also that he wouldn't see it because his eyes were put out. So it seemed to be two conflicting scriptures until it historically occurred. Historically occurred. And the law, her king and princes are among the Gentiles, those were the ones that previously were taken, and particularly Jeconiah. Because we find in the lineage he becomes an important link in joining two branches, the Solomonic branch and the Nathan branch, were like joined at the time of the 70-year captivity. But only Jeconiah. And so it came legally, they were joined not by actual members of the Solomonic branch, but theoretically, the Jeconiah branch inherited the other through a strange, what do they call those marriages? Not Levitical, it's a word like Levitical.
Leverite,
that's right, thank you. Marriage, that this, how it theoretically happened, that you had the strange thing happen. Because then the scripture said the Solomonic branch would be cut off and that's it. No more. But actually, later, in another way, it was joined, not not the direct line in that sign, but theoretically by absorbed into the other branch. And in the New Testament, you have this pointed out in the lineage of Luke and of Matthew, the two branches you can put together. The law is no more. But yeah, because you had to go to the priest for forgiveness. So there was no temple. And her prophets also find no vision from the Lord. Her prophets had no vision. But usually you found there was only the one.
Jeremiah.
All right. Jeremiah was one that was spared. Ezekiel, he was a priest and a prophet. He was spared. But they were each in their own places. Daniel was up in the highest echelon of authority. But these were like one, and there were many, and these others, they could say they were of the lineage, but no more communication, no more miraculous communication with the Lord like before in days of yore.
Brother Frank, these prophets then are not the false prophets that never had it. These are Jeremiah.
They were children of the prophets, and who were taken captive. But they normally, under the old arrangement, there was a favoritism shown. Now this is a big study in itself. I mean, I never took the time, because it would, once you get into this nitty gritty type of thing, the lineage and genealogy. This is what Paul says. Avoid endless genealogies and so forth, and it can be made very exciting, but it's not really wasting good time from better things and more valuable things. Yes.
So, but what's happening is, though, Jeremiah, he did get all the visions from the Lord before in instruction. He's being cut off at this point too, because there's no more.
No.
It's not him that we're talking
about. No, it's not him that's talking about. He's the talker. He's the talker that's doing this, saying this, as the mouthpiece of the Lord, the Lamentations. Yes?
It's kind of like a mention of the one who slapped Jeremiah when he gave his prophecy.
Yeah.
He's cut off.
Yeah. Yes, he said within 2 years, one of them, that the king is going to be, you don't have to worry. 2 years from now, everything's going to be back to normal. And now, 10. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit upon the ground and keep silence. And they have cast up dust upon their heads, girded themselves with sackcloth. So that all this is the elders. And usually an elder would sit on a stone or a chair or something elevated. Would be at an elevated place so they could be seen with, like, almost like, let's say, a pulpit, as it were. Now they're on the ground, you know, what do they call that posture where you're seated, where your knees akimbo, and you lament with the dust sackcloth. So instead of being elevated, they're like demoted, and they know it, and they feel it. And the virgins of Jerusalem hang down their heads to the ground. Now these were the virgins who were taken into captivity. But they are taken by a heathen people. And eventually what happened, there was an alleviation along another line, which I don't want to go into it today. Yes.
So this, you're saying this is after the, or this is during, brought into captivity, or is this happening as the siege is going on? Or can it be both?
No, this is after, I think.
Okay.
Because it says her king and her princes are among the Gentiles. Well, Zedekiah was among the Gentiles, so it's after. But he does go back and forth a little, showing that, and we know he lived 5 years longer because he went down to Egypt. My conjecture is that he eventually ended up back in Babylon himself. Doesn't say it, there's no proof, but I think all the evidences that exist suggest that, because the enemy, when he went down to Egypt, it says he's going to slay every one of you who differed with me. Jeremiah, the same. Those who differed. Well, those who did not differ with Jeremiah, and there were some, it mentions. We had read that in some study and in the past, the class. And so they would go back to the homeland, Babylon, if you take it. We know there were Jews in Egypt in late, much later ages, but how they got there, I don't want to get into that discussion. That's a big subject. But but the ones that went down to that place where he buried the stone in the ground, and he says the king is coming down, those that were in that captivity, their fate was, they didn't stay in Egypt, they were taken back captive. Those that were, had the right heart attitude towards Jeremiah and as the prophet of the Lord. So this reconciling the Bible with secular history and all, is difficult. For one reason is the secular historians are not religious, so the Bible doesn't mean that much to them. And if they had applied their intellect with an equal appreciation of God's word, they would have gotten much further. But even more further if they tread lightly the secular history, because a lot of it is dubious. Now we come to verse...
Should we have a short intermission?
Oh, yeah. What time is it?
It's past.
11. We start now with Lamentations chapter 2, verse 11. Let us read 11 and 12. Next.
Mine eyes do fail with tears. My bowels are troubled. My liver is poured upon the earth for the destruction of the daughter of my people, because the children and the sucklings swoon in the streets of the city. They say to their mothers, where is corn and wine? When they swooned as the wounded in the streets of the city, when their soul was poured out into their mother's bosoms.
Now, verse 11, when it says, mine eyes do fail with tears, whose eyes?
Jeremiah's.
Jeremiah's. And that can be proven later on, because when we follow through on the text after several verses, we see this is Jeremiah. I do not believe that any of these references that are very similar to this in Jeremiah's prophecy are God's tears, because tears are different than anger, than joy, than sensitivity. Like the Lord says that when someone injures, that is, persecutes one of the ones that are of the little flock, it's like a speck of dust getting in his eye. Well, that type of reaction. But tears of remorse have hopelessness mm-hmm. as a base. You're crying unrestrained. All these other things, whether it's joy or hate, anger, are purposed emotions. There's a thought to it, regulation attached to it. Even if it's fury, it's still. But weeping with profusely, with tears, is. And we think we can prove it in other ways, but this is not a moral study today. But except to say that verse 11 is Jeremiah, his eyes failing with tears, and his bowels are troubled. And we know that emotions are triggered to the bowels. People get diarrhea. Yes?
And we say, and Jeremiah was witnessing all the destruction, and before he was put in the grotto or the well, he would have seen, visually, been seeing the siege.
Oh, sure.
Going on.
Oh, yes.
And that to the point where he's put.
And he's even elevated where I believe he was.
Okay, so that's where.
So he could see, yes, and the enemy came up to where he was. He was like on the perimeter. Mm-hmm. He was on the perimeter of the city, outside the city wall, but not the third wall, but the second wall. And what we have outside, you have the garden tomb. That's outside the city wall. And the Jeremiah's, what I believe his grotto, is outside the city wall, right next to the Skull Hill, Golgotha. So, and what happened in the city also happened up there, but it took time. And he was told, the Nebuchadnezzar, he was not down the city, but he was in touch by messenger with his right-hand man, the general, that had a name, it mentions it in the book of Jeremiah, and he gave him specific instructions with regard to Jeremiah, to be very careful, because he did not want him to be slain, and the king of Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar.
And supposedly saw it too, that he had bread.
Oh yeah, and once he was captured, he was given choice. Well, he was said, Jeremiah, you come to Babylon with us, we'll house you, feed you, we'll be good to you, or you can stay here if you want, because with Gedaliah, it choices he wanted to get. He was a very generous offer. And Jeremiah said, I'll stay here in the city. Even though it had been gutted, as it were, there was a temporary arrangement with the vine dressers. And Gedaliah was made like a puppet. King for a few months. Yes.
So that's what I was actually getting at, though, is the fact that how this verse ties into his experience, just from the fact of how much of this he witnessed,
yeah.
Because this is him looking back now. Watching.
Yeah. So he, we mentioned earlier, even today, that he sometimes takes the past tense view. He sometimes takes the, I didn't use the exact word, but that he describes it as it's happening, but later,
mm-hmm.
because it's written on afterwards. But
and Brother Frank,
yes,
in which we'll come to, with maybe in the third chapter, it still talks about him crying and his eye, mine eye trickleth down and ceaseth not, without any intermission, till the Lord look down and behold from heaven. So you can see the difference that. It is Jeremiah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes. Now, the bowels are related to emotions. And now when it says, my liver is poured upon the earth, I think this is another elimination of another kind, and not the liver as we think of it. You know, you have kidneys, liver, gallstone, etc., and they said. But I think this had to do that not only was his bowels affected, but he urinated with the stream. He just lost control of everything. This man, you can see how patriotic for God he was. And they had a golden opportunity that they let slide down the drain, Israel. And here with these feelings, and then the way they treated him, why, it's unbelievable. Here is a man that's really concerned, a hero, national hero in the highest sense of the word. And then the next chapter, it'll tell all kinds of guff that he received every day, the type of persecutions he had. And for the destruction of the daughter of my people, because the children and the sucklings swoon in the streets of the city. And now this reminds you too, when we read this, except especially later on, a certain thing. We've already passed a few in an earlier portion of Jeremiah. They say to their mothers, "Where is corn and wine?" When they swooned as the wounded in the streets of the city. Now, the children, the sucklings, could not talk that way, but the term children. Now, it was much more broadly used in the Hebrew, and not only the Hebrew, but in other nations at other times in the past. You did not, when we say children, we think of a certain age category. We have infants, babes, infants, you know, a few weeks, months, and then you have children, and then you have teenagers, and then young men, and then the more mature, and then old. I mean, we have it's like our English language. We have like tenfold more words than in the Hebrew. So the terms used, and the children of Israel is used frequently, and that is a very broad term. It even includes the old people. It depends on the context that is used in. So it would mean that there was some intelligence that's involved, that you had the sucklings. That's clear. When you're at that stage, you can't broaden that. The most you can go is up to 8 or 9 years of age. That's the most. And there's a case of that that can be proven. But generally, that's only a couple of years. Yeah. Yes.
They didn't wean them until they were a good deal older.
Yeah, that's right.
We even saw an example of that in Turkey, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We're nursing this here. Pretty big kid, I thought.
We live in a different society today. I thank God that I was brought up on a farm and seen some of the things that many, many people never were privileged on that, except in Europe. and in certain parts of the country, but not many. The people today have a different culture. Yes?
But probably because of the diet and things there. I've often even wondered, wasn't it Daniel who was it that his mother left him to serve the priest?
Samuel.
He went pretty.
Yeah.
They said when he was weaned.
Yeah. Yes.
And that is interesting. At verse 11 and verse 12. Verse 11 is the word swoon.
Yeah.
Verse 12 it's swooned.
Yeah.
He did. And then Young's, the first one in verse 11,
yeah,
is to be or become feeble. And then in verse 12 is to show self feeble. So it's showing like a progression.
Yeah. Yeah, it affects, all are affected. And so when he says the destruction of the daughter of my people, the my people in this case would include all categories. But usually you think people more adults. But it includes, and it goes down in progression to people, children, sucklings.
Brother Frank, there's a famine that's going on.
Yeah, oh yes. Once the food ran out, they surrendered almost immediately. It was timed. They broke the walls, as it were, the day the food ran out, which is in there. And when I say food, the mothers ate their children. They boiled them, made a stew, they roasted them. I mean, this is just unbelievable, but this is what happens. Even today, 3-4 years ago, there was mountaineers were climbing the, I think it was in Chile, the Andes, and they went up this high mountain. They ran out of food. There was no grocery store within maybe 60 miles. And what did they do? They killed one of their own men and ate him. This is recent. So cannibalism was not an unusual thing in the past. And as you go back in the past, it increased. It was done. But in a siege, yes, that was done. And they say to the mothers, where is corn and wine? They're interested in food and drink. Because wine was the water that was used. Wine was water, the beverage, the regular beverage. Because water is scarce. And you have to carry it in a vessel. And it was used for cooking, for cleansing, for other things. But the wine, you didn't have to worry being polluted. It's a natural alcoholic beverage, so it's self-purifying. It's safe. And people give, it's like in Germany, beer to their children today. They bring them up on beer, some of the in Germany. There's some people bring their children up with wine in Italian countries. But not here in America. See, we live in such a. It's like these prefabricated homes. We're in a prefabricated society here, insulated from knowing what's going on in the world, really. But we have a lot of books. And when they swooned as the wounded in the streets of the city, when their soul was poured out in their mother's bosom. When they fainted from hunger, they died in their mother's bosom. You can see how hard this would be for mothers. And Moses spoke of this.
Deuteronomy 28?
Yeah. and Leviticus
26.
Yeah. And, let's read 13 and 14.
What things shall I take to witness for thee? What things shall I liken to thee, O daughter of Jerusalem? What shall I equal to thee, that I may comfort thee, O virgin daughter of Zion? For thy breach is great like a sea. Who can heal thee? Thy prophets have seen vain and foolish things for thee, and they have not discovered thine iniquity to turn away thy captivity, but have seen for the false burdens and causes of banishment.
All right. Yeah. So, the hopelessness of this situation is revealed in these verses. And what testimony could he give? Now, so he mentions, what shall I liken to thee, O daughter of Jerusalem? Notice it was daughter of Zion, daughter of Judah, daughter of Jerusalem. To make it so it's not too, what do they call, vain repetition, but all mean more or less relatively synonymous terms. So, and when you see such situation going on, what kind of consolation can you give under those conditions? So if it's impossible to witness to a man that's inebriated, drunk, if a man is drunk, how much can you reason with him on spiritual things? Well, the same would be true with other conditions of duress, such as starving to death. You can't. So he feels hopeless, but on the same time, he is given enough food, Jeremiah, providentially, even though this is happening all around him. He is on a starvation diet, but he's lasting a little longer, we find out. He's suffering from this, but the others more. The others more. And what shall I equal to thee, that I may comfort thee, O virgin daughter of Zion? For thy breach is great like the sea. Who can heal thee? There's the breach not only in the walls, a breach in their mental, physical situation. There's this breach of open to the enemy, fainting, swooning, helpless to resist any longer. The virgin daughter, we spoke on that a long time ago in the book of Jeremiah. I'll avoid that. Now, verse 14, where it says that the prophets have seen vain and foolish things for thee, we had in the book of Jeremiah itself, we had prophets saying different things.
Pasher. And
yeah, there were three of them mentioned by name mm-hmm. in earlier chapters of Jeremiah.
Prophesied smooth things.
Yeah.
In 2 years he's going to go away. You're going to crush him.
And when it says thy prophets, it shows that the true prophets, the true Christians, the true Jews are a minority. A definite, distinct minority of the populace. And so while it says many are called, the many that are called are not proportionately speaking are great as far as if they were searching for truth, that being called in that direction, if their heart is drawn that way, they still don't know the Father. But the Bible, just the Bible itself, the existence of it, and what it claims to be, in the sense is a call, but it's not the personal thing that happens as you exercise yourself to look into religions. Like Pastor Russell, what did he do? He found out there was a discrepancy in nominal Christianity. They believed in hellfire, the Trinity, whatnot. He couldn't digest that. So what did he do? He studied the Hindu, Buddhism, other religions. He made a serious study. And he felt that was foolish. That. Then he thought, well, maybe the Bible, you know, you've been spoon-fed from the Bible by other people. What about going to it and doing it yourself to see? And it was when he self-investigated the Bible that he saw it said a lot of things that are not known. And then and that's how he... But then when he read that not known, then you're getting closer to the Father. And then the Father, like beckons, come, you know, and then sends Jesus. Points to Jesus to... That's one I would interested in, that has the potential. No matter how weak or what they are, they have the potential of making the high calling because of faith. Faith is a precious, precious item. And that's even the natural faith. Now back to here. They seem to, and they have not discovered thine iniquity to turn away thy captivity. They did not see that they had sinned in the need of repentance. Yes?
It reminds me of the principle of the watchman that Ezekiel brought out in chapter 33. They were false prophets. They weren't pointing out the people's sin, which would have given them a chance to repent and hopefully avert the trouble.
And to take the religion today, I mean, of course now things are being held in askance and question by Catholics today. We see a lot of things happening that are very unique today, like the Pope believing in evolution, that he admits that persecution of the past, the Inquisition, but not by him and the leaders, mm-hmm. but by Catholics, the children of the Church, not the Church. So they view the Church as those consecrated to the papacy or some other religion. I mean, that's the principle that's being seen. But they have seen for thee false burdens. But they laid on Israel the false burdens, and Jesus called attention to that with the Pharisees. Yes?
I was thinking too that they did not discover thy iniquities. Although Jeremiah had to keep continually pointing these things out, when you read in the book of Jeremiah, he includes himself.
Yeah.
It's the very thing they don't do.
Yeah.
Is include themselves.
Yeah. And they burdened, like Jesus said with regard to the scribes and Pharisees, that they, for instance, they had laws about how you eat, diet, a religious diet. And they are very particular about the cumin and the little seeds and all, and the clean and the unclean and all. But the real, they and swallow a camel.
Yeah. Wanted a gnat.
Yeah, yeah. So they made the people, you have to go to Mass, you have to go and say so many rosary things, and so many candles, scapulars, all kinds of things. These are the burdens. They're not real burdens. And they're cheap and can be acquired by anybody without relieving themselves of the sin. That's which is the real problem.
They wash the outside of the cup.
Yeah.
They actually feel they can relieve themselves. They make an appointment to do the very same thing next week, but they pray for this past week for sin.
Yes, they pray even for the sainthood of certain ones, but they know in advance they're going to make so-and-so a saint. So they beatify him. He's already been nominated as the candidate, but they're praying, they pray for so it's artificial, artificial and causes of punishment. You're excommunicated if you don't cooperate. And the priest who's not in line, they can't serve the sacraments, the Eucharist. There are all kinds of banishment, where you're prohibited from serving, and you can be defrocked, lose your position, but not the position with the Lord. That's the real.
And even with the Protestants, you can't get buried in holy ground. It's certain.
Yes, there are limitations on the. You know, I remember one family that I knew. They couldn't bury their people. This was an Italian family. I knew the mother, and she was a very a marvelous influence for a tremendous amount of people. And members of her family that were Catholics couldn't be buried in the Catholic cemetery. Because they had questioned things of the church. They were looked on as problems. And what did she do? She bought a cemetery. Bought the cemetery. And then they had no problems.
I know.
And Brother Russell did the same thing for himself, right, down in Pennsylvania. Bought a place there at that time. And here we have. Let's read 15 and 16.
All that pass by clap their hands at thee. They hiss and wag their head at the daughter of Jerusalem, saying, Is this the city that men call the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? All thine enemies have opened their mouth against thee. They hiss and gnash the teeth. They say, We have swallowed her up. Certainly this is the day that we looked for. We have found it. We have seen it.
Okay. Now, these that pass by, they would be going, let's say, from Egypt to Syria. Well, the only way you can go from Egypt to Syria, you have to pass through other ground. And so you have to go through Israel, either on the west side of Jordan, this side, or the east side, the other side. But you go through parts of Israel. But now when they're on the west side, which is the more heavily trafficked, when they're at this time, because what happened... there was no real garrison there. It was the land was desolate. So then you took the shortest route, and the shortest route would be going right up the coast or going up the mountain, the top mountain. There's like roads that are elevated in Israel. And you have the low road and the high road. And you have the same thing on the other side of the Dead Sea. The high road and then the low road. So it's just the reverse. But when they be near Jerusalem, and we could see it in the distance, and they would have to go right by some of these paths, they would be saying, that is this the city that was, and it's a wreck, there's nothing there. And they would say it among themselves, and glory in it. The Muslims now want to eradicate the Jews from Israel. That's their real desire, not to placate, compromise, but to exterminate. And here it happened. They were made desolate, but this time they're not going to be, because we're in the end time period. And they say, notice, all thine enemies have opened their mouth against thee. They hiss, gnash the teeth. They say, we have swallowed up Israel. This is the day that we looked for. We have found. We have seen. Now this is purposely done. But now the next verse, Jeremiah says, the Lord hath done it. Not them. The Lord hath done that which he hath devised. See, in reading this, thousands and thousands of people go right by and don't see this. And how many times we mentioned? Four or five times in a row in one verse? It's the emphasis is on those pronouns. They could never have touched or done anything to Israel, God's people, unless he
allowed it.
He hath fulfilled his word that he had commanded in the days of old. He hath thrown down, hath not pitied. He hath caused thine enemy to rejoice over thee. He hath set up the horn of thine adversaries. Now, what is good too, Jeremiah was careful not to self-laudate himself, but he is given credit that the warnings given to Israel were not solely done by him, but by other prophets before him, who faithfully warned Israel, many of whom we don't know who their names are even, but who were used of the Lord, had prepared. So he had the right perspective, even though he was the one most prominently used. He was definitely Jeremiah in Israel at this time, at the time of the action that is being spoken about of the past. So he counteracts the we with, I haven't counted them, but probably just about the same number of we's. He puts it, he, the Lord, to counteract each of these other things were repeated. Let's see. That was 17. We read 18.
No, we didn't read 17 either.
No, we didn't? Oh, no. That's why. All right, let's read 17 and 18.
The Lord hath done that which he hath devised. He hath fulfilled his word that he had commanded in the days of old. He hath thrown down and hath not pitied. He hath caused thine enemy to rejoice over thee. He hath set up the horn of thine adversaries. Their heart cried unto the Lord, O wall of the daughter of Zion, let tears run down like a river, day and night. Give thyself no rest. Let not the apple of thine eye cease.
All right. Now, what is Jeremiah doing in verse 17 and 18? Telling that the Lord is the one that's been responsible. But then these that had in the past spoken concerning these things, why, it even goes back to Moses, where he told that there would be this punishment. But of course, the emphasis in Leviticus 26, I think it's 26, that about the seven times there is the seven of the gospel age, the
Gentile times,
the 12. 2,520 years. That's right. Seven times 360. But it's interesting that the number seven and the number 10 are completions, and the 70 is like a mini picture of the diaspora that would occur in connection with the similar destruction of the city that would later occur under Rome. Because what happened in 606, when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the city, happened when Vespasian and Titus later did the same thing. And so one is like many. Now, what this would mean, it's very interesting that with natural Israel, you had the premonitory clique, this that Jeremiah is speaking, and then Rome. And we have the same with the Christian.
French Revolution.
And then, the time of trouble at the end of the age. So there are certain, not only is history repeating itself in many different ways, but this is the Lord's method of instruction. Yeah, it's their cry, their heart. Who will let thee give thyself? Now, Jeremiah is saying, in effect, he's urging others to see things as he sees it. The whole lesson of this, the lamentations of Jeremiah, he writes for his people, that they might lament, and not just him. Instead of the lamentations of Jeremiah, he's hoping that these will be the lamentations of Israel in memorial of what happened and what God's instruction was before, how he dealt during their experience, and what is to come in the future. So he's writing this for posterity, and he could not have written this under conditions of duress while it's happening. This is a looking back. He could not have done this, write all these things down while the city is being burned, while the famine is on. No, he's writing this afterward. Therefore, he'd have to be in a position where he had the means, not onerous, but, well, in the fact that he received persecution, but where he could do it with in peaceful situation. Now, when we read of his going to Egypt, back down there, that was not conducive to it. Now, where could he be where he could write these things? I think Babylon. And there, just like the advice he gave, when you go to Babylon, you better not be impatient. You're going to be there a long time. Build houses and inhabit them while you're in captivity. So while they're in captivity, what happened? Nebuchadnezzar, brutal as he was a very shrewd king and gave them a measure of liberty. Look at Daniel, the three prophets, the three Hebrew Jews. High office. Couldn't be much higher.
Jeremiah must have gotten special treatment.
Pardon me?
Jeremiah must have gotten special treatment.
That's right. That's especially when he spoke to his own people. And they say, they agree with everything you're saying, Jeremiah. We hardly agree. I mean, this would be that they would think of Israel as a stiff-necked generation, not listening to instruction, but they, of course, feel they're in the more secure. But at least they then would respect Jeremiah. Yeah. So he had the opportunity to do this. And this type of a subject, and notice it's structured. Remember, we said the first chapter, A, B, C, D, or the alphabet, and then the next chapter, the same thing, and then the third chapter, AAA, BBB, CCC, DDD, they're different. This is structured. This could not be done under pressure. He had time to do this. So I think Jeremiah lived to an old age because he had a 40-year ministry, and he didn't begin that ministry until he was, at least 18 or 20 years of age, at least. So you tack that on, and then the 5 years in Egypt, I mean, you're beginning to add up. So therefore, to do that, this is done carefully for posterity that he'd like to leave. And this is sort of like a personalized testimony. It reminds us very much, but he was faithful. Solomon, his Ecclesiastes, and his Proverbs that have been recorded, but more particularly Ecclesiastes, was like a memorial of what the mistakes he made of the past. He's memorializing, and he includes himself, like Daniel does. Well, wonderful character. Oh, yeah. Now, what we were then... what verse are we on now?
18, the end of it.
All right. Let tears run down like river day and night. Give thyself no rest. Let not the apple of thine eye cease. This cease to cry, because when you get something in your eye, it gets blurry. That's nature's way to clear the thing out. And the impediment is this, what had happened to the revered city. Now we're 18. Now let's see. 19. I don't think we can finish.
All right, let's go.
19:20. Next.
Arise, cry out in the night. In the beginning of the watches, pour out thine heart like water before the face of the Lord. Lift up thy hands toward him for the life of thy young children, that faint for hunger in the top of every street. Behold, O Lord, and consider to whom thou hast done this. Shall the woman eat their fruit, and children of a span long? Shall the priest and the prophet be slain in the sanctuary of the Lord?
All right. And so he, in writing this, is going through a traumatic experience himself. We have, for instance, take people who have been taken captive and beaten by the enemy, put in cell life in Vietnam, They were put in a 4-foot cage, like they couldn't stand up, they couldn't move around, and they were caged like animals, like a cage of bird, an adult, a warrior, and that be done for years. Now say they're rescued, and with all the beatings, no, wouldn't they have nightmares? Wouldn't they have traumatic experiences? When they used to be, I remember the shell shock, they'd hear a boom, ooh, you know, they relive. Some explosion down the street that's minor, but it would trigger something in their brain and they go wild, they go crazy. They're uncontrolled. And so we find that he feels that if this sorrow and trauma is based on the need for their recognition of their sin and failure to obey the Lord's instruction in times past, and he wants them also to see the justice, the reason God did what he did, acted so, what appeared to be cruel, unpitied, that it was justified. They merited everything that they got because of disobedience. It was no fault on God's part. It's their part. Well, that's something worth having a trauma about and keeping in memory. That's something that would be beneficial to them, because as they would remember these things, then they would then get down and cry and all that, and say, you know, that they would want to be in an attitude of heart and mind that when the Lord would be forgiving, that they would be in a position to be received into his presence. And they then learned the lesson that God is pitiful, he is merciful to those who repent. This trauma, and thus he puts his whole heart and soul in the writing of this to stir it up, to really stir it up, not just to write about it like a historical record, but that it would bring good results. And so he pictures it as though it's now happening, but actually he's writing it years later. Lift up thine hands toward him for the life of thy young children, when they're already in captivity, the ones that survived, so that you instruct them, your children, in captivity, hoping that they will not be like the instructions of the children under the teaching of the false priests, the false kings, the bad instruction, that having learned the lesson, you turn it to your children. You tell them that. And try to bring them up with their hearts directed towards the Lord. And then it mentions about the eating of the children, the span long. Span is 9 inches. That's not very long, is it? It isn't very... 3/4 of a foot. A foot's only that big. Yeah. And faint for hunger in the top of every street, priest and prophet being slain. You know, they were under priests as well. Let us read 21 and 2.
The young and the old lie on the ground in the streets. My virgins and my young men are fallen by the sword. Thou hast slain them in the day of thine anger. Thou hast killed and not pitied. Thou hast called as in a solemn day my terrors round about, so that in the day of the Lord's anger none escaped nor remained. Those that I have swaddled and brought up hath mine enemy consumed.
All right. And the young and old lie and say death. In other words, the destruction was indiscriminate. And an earlier verse said that the beauty and all was discredited when they were intent on destruction, and they didn't want to parley over anything because it was an infant or a youngster or a fair maiden. In their anger, the enemy, they did what the Lord intended. But the ones who escaped, you do not get, unless you're familiar with Jeremiah. You have to not just read Jeremiah. He gave advice how to speed your life to be saved, and the ones that obeyed Jeremiah and defected to the enemy became traitors by going out to the king, like he said, and you will not be harmed. He says, I guarantee it. You know, the Lord said that. Those that did that were the ones who escaped with their life. And now from that, they should get the lesson. And then thou hast called as in a solemn day my terrors round about, so that the day none escaped. And he is saying, in effect, if I understand it correctly, that all this that has been narrated, so let's say in chapter 2, thus far, these terrors were designed to be solemnized, memorialized, purposefully, with all the gory details. Because anything less would not penetrate. Now we can see how some Jews are of this, and they're not being called to the high calling, that some of these at the Wailing Wall do really cry and all. I mean, even one of the last trips I saw one woman there, she was unbelievable that her at the well with, you know, the, and it wasn't put on. And those whom God swaddled and brought up, the enemy consumed. And what happens, if people, when they're brought up, they're given instruction, let's say, but what are they taught in the schools today? When you once go to the school, forget what your parents taught you. You're yourself. You don't want to be tied to your mother's apron strings. I mean, this is the counsel actually given by professors on this side. And these young people, as they are impressionable. They may not think they are, but they are. And that sounds rather good. Yes. You want to be above your parents and your own, and you're going to use your own judgment, your own thinking and all. It's very appealing, but it's not sound. It's not sound at all. It seems plausible. And if here the Lord instructed his people faithfully, he went on public record in the past with sending the prophets continually, all that it was available, and repeated even on deaf ears. So they wanted to put the this way, they got so tired of hearing the doom prophets that yet when they grew up, what did they do? They didn't follow that counsel. So this is a lesson for humanity, not only for Christians and for Jews, but for humanity as a whole. That the good things don't throw out. They say, don't throw out the baby with the water, see. Figuratively happens very often in principle in life. Yes?
Verse 18 and 19 is Jeremiah advising people to repent and
Yes. Mm-hmm. He says, he's saying, in effect, without saying direct, he enjoins them to be like me. I mean, to see the things that as I see it, with this is the way it affects me. My eyes went down. You know, he's saying to his people. And I beg you to think on these things so we can see what a character Jeremiah was, who was brought up from his mother's womb. Remember, even before he was born. And then he said, Jeremiah, and here he's of this soft disposition, and yet he says, I'm going to make your forehead like steel. So this was a schooling process for Jeremiah. He had the other, the soft, the tender side and all, but the way, how do you harden iron and all, you go through that antimony, sir, and furnace, and cold, and chill, and then you have an instrument of both qualities. God is pictured as having as a jasper stone, soft-hearted, pitiful, merciful, kind, loving, the jasper stone,
sod.
And then the diamond, which is the hardest. And these are the two qualities evidently he's looking for in his people, that they might be like him and like Christ. And Christ manifested this soft, pliable, merciful side, as well as the strict side. Ye generation of vipers and so forth, you know, the way he called them. Those that didn't have the right. So we close then here, and God willing, chapter 3 would be next scenario, if it's to be.